The Food Engineer Podcast es traído a ustedes por Caldamentum, una empresa de consultoría para la industria de alimentos y bebidas. Para más información, visita www.caldamentum.com. A menudo escuchamos la gente hablar del término super taster. Y nos viene en mente la imagen de un ser avanzado que puede discernir entre el más sutil y efímero de los sabores. Pero en realidad, este concepto está atado a la habilidad innata de percibir ciertos compuestos amargos con alta sensitividad. En su libro How to Taste, la autora Mandy Naglich nos resume la ciencia detrás de cómo catar alimentos y bebidas y nos lleva de la mano en su viaje para aprender lo que es un super taster. Además, nos provee con un sistema de su propia creación para catar cualquier comida o bebida y así expandir nuestra biblioteca personal de sabores. Esto y mucho más en el episodio número 57. Bienvenidos a The Food Engineer Podcast, un podcast dedicado a la exploración de alimentos y bebidas fermentadas. Yo soy tu anfitrión, Cristian Mercado. Welcome to a new episode of the Food Engineer Podcast. Today we have a guest that you have heard before here, and she's coming back to talk to us a little bit more about herself and her new project. Welcome, Mandy Naglich. How are you, Mandy?
Hi, good. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you here. So the rumor is that you have a new project, but before we get there, for those of you who don't know Mandy yet, will you be able to elaborate about yourself, who you are, and how do you get into the world of tasting?
Sure. I'm Mandy Naglich, as you said. I'm an advanced roan. I also have all kinds of certifications across the beverage alcohol sector. So a certified cider professional. I have my WSET in spirits. I've been teaching educational classes on drinks for about 5 years now. And my new project is a book called How to Taste, A Guide to Discovering Flavor and Savoring Life, which covers a lot of my experiences as a professional taster, as well as interviews with over 100 food scientists and professional tasters that all went together to make this book project all about our senses.
So writing a book is a huge endeavor, and getting without getting yet into the contents of it, how do you transition from being in beer, spirits, education as a whole to become an author?
Great question. I have been freelance writing as a journalist for a little while, so I've had plenty of pieces commissioned. You know, they start at these kind of little 300-400 word explainers. And then as you continue on through freelancing, I got to the place where I was writing 2,000-4,000 word feature stories that were fully reported. And so when you look at it that way, that's almost a chapter of a book in itself. So when the pandemic shut everything down, I kind of thought of it as if I can write 10 back-to-back feature stories on the same theme, that would be a book, which would be a great project for while I couldn't really go out and teach classes in person. You know, no one was excited about smelling and tasting things all together in that time during 2020. So I was looking for something else to fill all that time and that work that I had typically done as in-person classes.
I would like to add that some people couldn't even smell during that time.
Very scary time. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Me being one of them. Yeah. And as someone who has worked in the world of beer, spirits, wine, this whole experience of the pandemic was very scary if your livelihood was made with that. So I commend you for engaging in such a big project during a time of uncertainty.
Definitely. And I mean, if there is a silver lining coming out of the pandemic, it's hard to think of them. But a lot of the scientists I spoke to, actually, because of that kind of popular awareness of how important our senses, especially our sense of smell, is, they've gotten a lot more funding. And I think in the next couple of 5-10 years, we're going to see a lot more research come out about our senses because of that public awareness of how easy it is to lose our taste and smell and how detrimental that is to how we experience life.
Indeed. So, Mandy, you mentioned that you have several certifications going from Cicerone, Insider, the WSET as well. But you also mentioned that you're a certified taster. So can you explain us what is a certified taster and how does one get to be one?
Yes. So the organization that I'm certified through is called Araxa. They certify for a couple different specialties, including cider, beer, dairy, I believe. My actual certificate says certified beer taster. So what we end up getting certified in is, I believe it was 36 compounds, being able to sense them and describe them at threshold. So what the human threshold is for sensing that compound, across 36 different compounds, knowing where they came from, what they taste like in different beers, and being able to identify them consistently. So it's 5 days of training, a day of exam, and being able to now, it's a blessing and a curse because I can definitely sense certain compounds, immediately. If anything has artificial vanilla in it, it's, very distracting for me, things like that. But, there are all different kinds of esters, phenols, sulfur compounds, what else? Trying to think of what other compounds we were trained in, but beer flaws and then things typical of beer flavor, pyrazines, things like that. So being able to be certified to taste those flavors.
And that's quite an advanced endeavor when you compare it to your usual off-flavor tasting kits for beer, which are 4, 8, 12. Now we're talking 36, so about three times as many.
I really hate that term off-flavor kit too, so.
Please, go on.
I just think, like I said, how it was a blessing and a curse, right? If you're learning in context of a flavor and you're categorizing it in your sensory memory as a quote-unquote flaw or off, it's very hard to work across cultures. For example, working in sake, cork taint or TCA that we know is not considered a flaw in sake. Brewers will smell it. It will be in their sake and it's, totally part of a saleable product. So I think having that sensory memory where my brain lights up and says flaw, 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 or even diacetyl, where diacetyl is quite prominent throughout England and even parts of Germany and the Czech Republic. Sensing that as a flaw is really distracting as a taster and I think doesn't allow you to work well across cultures. I think we just need to learn all flavors as a flavor because they're all just chemical compounds and they all have their own contexts, you know? So I really hate kind of drilling when you're getting into beer or any medium, drilling anything into you as a flaw, I think is really dangerous. I mean, look at natural wine now, right? Like, tastes so strongly of Brett and winemakers were conditioned for years, for centuries to think of Brett as such a flaw. So it can just cause, people to kind of get stuck in their ways and not see the potential in flavors or be accepting of things culturally. So, yeah.
That's a great point that you bring there because it's a sort of programming that we have gone into initially with the good intention to learn about what may cause something that is considered a flaw. But Now we're talking about the world of fermented products where there are a plethora of compounds in there that are similar across fermented products. And in some of them might be a good thing. In others, it may not be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do talk in your book about building yourself your own dictionary of flavors. How do you go about that when they're for different drinks, for different environments, and maybe hanging out with different people?
Yeah, I think something that is so great about trying to kind of build your mental, filing cabinet or closet of flavors is really it creates a lot of connections across your life. For exactly as you said, a lot of the flavors that we love are fermentation flavors. So whether that's coming from cheese, coming from beer, kimchi, wine, everything has these similar flavors and being able to connect them and realize how things are connected, just be a little bit more grounded in the way that our food and drinks are produced, I think is really interesting once you start becoming familiar enough with those flavors to start noticing. I mean, even just like the simple, in beer, we all know that yogurt tang is the same thing that you're getting in like a Berliner Weiss or something like that. And just kind of being able to connect these things in your sensory memory, I think is just something that adds a little more color and interest to your life that if you're not paying attention to what you taste, you don't make those connections.
That's a good point. One thing that you talk about is how tasting is more than just the interaction of the aromas, the taste, the everything. It's also your surroundings. It's also the noise. It's the color of the walls. And in your book, you talk about a story about the carrotness of carrot. Can you share a little bit about that without spoiling the book for everybody?
Yeah, it's a reference to an episode. It's on Netflix. It's called Chef's Table. And it's this very beautiful kind of documentary series highlighting different chefs. And in the episode about Blue Hill at Stone Barn, which I'm just a couple hours south from here in New York City, Ruth Reichel says that the carrot that he serves at Blue Hill at Stone Barn is like the essence of carrot. She says it has the carrotness of carrot. And I was just so curious because I was like, what could a carrot taste like? Like watching this on TV, I was like, what could a carrot taste like that makes it so, you know, the essence of carrot? So we went up there for my birthday and anniversary combo because it is quite an like expensive and intense meal. And we were served the carrot, you know, and it's this like carrot that I've been thinking about from seeing on TV. And it's served on this like special plate that has no reflection. And I'm in this huge dining room with these soaring ceilings. And there's a person literally handing me a carrot on a plate, you know, telling me how special it is, how it was grown right outside. I can see out the window to the farm and there's all these things coming together. And I was like, oh, wow, this is the carrot. And I took a bite and I mean, it tasted like a good carrot, but I was just thinking, you know, if I closed my eyes and ate this carrot next to any other carrot without all this context and this story and this special plating and everything, I don't know that I would notice the difference in the flavor. It doesn't mean that I'm not enjoying that carrot in my meal with the special carrot in it, but I think so much comes together and it really relates to like, when you're on vacation and you have a really special glass of wine, you're like, oh, I'm going to bring the bottle of wine home with me from the winery. And all of a sudden you get home to your apartment in New York and it doesn't taste the way it tasted in Italy when the sun was setting over the mountains and things. And it's there's a little bit about flavor we just have to appreciate in its context and try not to recreate it or, be able to change it. I think your hummus and carrots and the very special carrot, it's all carrots.
The thing that you brought up in there, you're talking about the experience when you travel abroad and you have these products that are so magical. All the components that make it up, and that happened to me recently after a trip to Spain. I think ham doesn't taste the same outside of Spain. The same thing applies for cava, at least in my apartment or in my house in New York. Mm-hmm. So the ability to build your own file cabinet of flavors, the ability to do all these things, how do you separate that context of what you had there versus trying to create a unique experience for, let's say, a guest, a couple friends that are coming over for dinner? How do you go about that?
I think knowing how much your surroundings affects what you taste allows you to be able to create more special experiences. So for example, knowing that like very loud bassline heavy music is going to affect what you taste. Really our taste signals travel from our tongue to our brain through our inner ear. So all of that intense bassline is kind of jostling just the signals of taste to your brain. So obviously they're going to be muted. Knowing that a little jazz music is proven over and over again to make people rate things more highly when they're eating them. You can kind of curate a special experience to make sure there's less interference with, you know, the ham from Italy or the ham from Spain. And that you're trying to uplift it in every way that you can. But I don't think tasting or appreciating flavor is about trying to recreate flavors over and over again. I think it's understanding and appreciating what we taste and then trying to create great experiences with it. I think it's less about, trying to recreate and more about recognizing how things are connected, really making your memories a little bit deeper and more contextual by having these sensory inputs, you know, going out of your way to pay attention to your smells and your flavors so you can create a deeper memory rather than trying to recreate. You'll get a whiff one day, you'll be somewhere, it won't be Spain, and you'll think, oh, this is reminding me of that really incredible ham from Spain that I remember. But it's not about recreating it, it's just kind of about bringing up that memory and having kind of that sensory connection to it.
That's a good point. On a recent trip to Russian River Brewing, I had a beer and I grew up in the countryside, and my uncle was my neighbor, used to have horses. And there was one specific beer that when I opened it, it was just like the blanket that you put before you put the saddle on a horse. And it just hit me, and it just transported me to a different place, to a different time. And trying to explain that to someone can be difficult sometimes if they have not had the same lived experiences as you had. So I think your strategy of building the dictionary, that closet, that file cabinet, it really helps, because then you can contextualize it in the experience of other people and then being able to talk more deeply about it.
Yeah. I wonder which beer that was. It Consecration? I love their, I'm guessing it was, yes, a Brettanomyces beer, obviously, that has those kind of barnyardy flavors that we grow to love.
I'm impressed how you picked up the exact beer.
I love Russian River, so.
it is a great beer.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how, in the context of flavors, right, there's more than just what you're having there, how you experience it, but there's also the vessel in which they come. You did mention that when you were having the carrotness of carrot was on an opaque plate that did not reflect the light from the lamp above or the walls around. But then as someone that deals mostly in beer and wine and spirits, I get a lot of mixed messages about glassware, about the shape of the glassware that goes with a specific type of drink. How do you go about defining which one's better, and what are some myths associated with that?
Yeah, I thought in the book it was really important to me to make sure everything that I suggested or recommended was backed up in science. There's a lot of history, to your point, about like in beer, all these different beer styles going in specific glasses, which is great to honor. But I wanted to come from the point of view of actual flavor science. Really, flavor is all about just getting those molecules from the glass to either your olfactory bulb or your palate. So really the most important things in a glass are just if the opening is wide enough to get your nose, that it, your nose can get to it, you know, as you're taking a sip, it should be wide enough that aroma is able to float up to your nose. So something like a champagne flute is kind of off the table. It's not a helpful beverage. And then the other thing is kind of that bell-shaped bulb of a glass actually does. There's some really cool footage from a sniffer cam that the vapors of ethanol actually do collect in those sides of that bulb. So something even just like a plain white wine glass that has that curve, ethanol will collect there and allow this kind of free space in the center of the glass where there are far fewer or almost no ethanol vapors for you to dive in your nose and really get all the great aromas that aren't being afflicted by that alcohol aroma that we're trying to avoid. So those are two major things in a glass. Even a stem, I don't think is something necessary. It's nice to be able to control the temperature of your drink by either having your hand on the bulb or the stem. And also if you have some kind of hand lotion or, I mean, the last couple of years, antibacterial on your hands keeps kind of a strong smelling hand away from your nose. But really it's just that wide enough opening and that bell shape, if you can find it, is great. I think a lot of the myths about, people will say, oh, this more narrow opening will direct the wine down your palate in a way that you get more sweetness, or this more open will spread the wine over your palate, you know, to have bigger flavors and more tannins. But that happens automatically in our mouth. There's no directionality, I think, of these like different sizes and openings of wine glasses. And when it comes to things like different fancy glasses, like the Spiegeloo for IPAs that has, you know, the different shapes and things like that, it's really, if there's a difference at all, it's very minimal. And I think the most important thing, like I said, is just any glass at all is better than no glass. And then if you can, something that kind of holds that aroma in, so kind of a tulip lip, something nice and wide that you can get your nose into, is the most important thing.
It's great to know. As a lived experience, I had a friend who was a Boy Scout, and he would rather drink out of a cleaned out mayo jar than any stainless or plastic cup.
Interesting.
Is there a difference when it comes to materials?
So that's a good question. In some contexts, like very clean, hard plastic, I think is actually a great vessel for judging out of. The thing that happens with glass, especially glass that's used over and over again, is they can get these little micro scratches in them that, one, acts as a nucleation point, kind of makes your glass look dirty, and two, are hard to clean. So there can just be a little bit of grime that kind of throws an off flavor in there. And so if you're judging someone or you're trying to give them feedback, and it could be like a smell coming from your glass, I don't know, like I don't clean my dishwasher often enough, I'm sure. You kind of get that dishwashery smell. That can be a huge negative. But yeah, glass is great. Plastic, if you, especially if you're recycling it, is a great thing when you're judging. But yeah, that was my least favorite trend ever. Do you remember? It was like a couple years ago that everything was being served out of mason jars. Like a lot of breweries were using mason jars. Anything that like obstructs your mouth, like it's so hard to get your mouth around the rim of a mason jar is going to be a no-go for me. But other than that, like if it's an easy drinking mayonnaise jar, he can totally drink out of it.
What about cans or cans and bottles overall? You didn't mention any vessel that allows you to get your nose in there to get that passing sniff, that secondary sniff, and so on. That if you guys want to know more about this, get the book. But what about those vessels that have a very narrow opening? And yeah, what's the experience like, or how is it diminished or improved?
Yeah, so something like a can, a bottle, drinking iced coffee out of a glass with a lid, even a coffee cup lid, those are really all just obstructing aroma. So about 80% of what we construct in our brain as flavor is actually coming from our olfactory bulb, from our aroma senses. So by obstructing that, especially hot coffee, something that's so aromatic, like putting a lid on it is just blocking most of the flavor from it. The rest of what makes up flavor is obviously from our taste buds. And then what we were talking about before, the inputs, visual inputs, even a little bit of hearing, and then our touch sensations. But by having a narrow bottle opener where you can't get the aroma, or a narrow can, or something with a lid, lid and straw is the number one flavor blocker that's out there. you want to get as much aroma as you can to really construct that flavor and understand the nuance of whatever beverage or food that you have that someone spent so much time making that flavor, you know, and then we're just blocking it with a lid. You're totally missing out on all their hard work.
So now when you go in your car, don't have your coffee with your lid. Just wait till you get to a safe place, open it up, and indulge yourself in the experience that is the aroma, the textures, and the taste of coffee.
Exactly. Exactly.
So talking about tasting, and talking about how different people might perceive flavors and tasting, what can you tell me about the so-called super tasters?
Yeah, I did talk to the woman who coined the term super taster in the lab. And it's something that she even said to me she wished she came up with a different word for, because really all that super taster is a genetic marker for being able to taste bitterness, especially very intensely. So people who are super tasters are sensitive to a certain group of bitter compounds, that they're much more sensitive to people than people who are just categorized as tasters. And then there's also a category of non-tasters. And basically all that is just different alleles on a gene. If you have the ones for tasting this bitterness, you're a super taster. You'll think these bitter chemicals, especially PTCs, what they use as the test, are extremely bitter to the point of like almost painful. A taster will have one tasting allele and one non-tasting allele, so they can sense the bitter compounds, but they're not going to cause them any kind of unpleasantness. And then a non-taster, basically, if they have PTC on their palate, they don't sense it at all. So at some of my book events, we've been doing super taster tests, which has been really fun just to see. You can always see them grab the PTC strip off their palate and like grimace when they're a super taster. But it doesn't give you any superpowers. It does not make you a better wine taster. It doesn't mean you should go become a chef. It's really just this genetic marker that you can go your whole life being a super taster and not know. Honestly, you're usually a more picky eater for super tasters because they have this strong intensity when it comes to bitterness. Like when they're young, if they try something and it's it's so bitter, it's painful to them, they'll really become a picky eater. And if no one breaks them out of that later in life, they can remain picky their entire lives. So if anything, it's an anti-superpower. It's a burden a little bit to be a super taster.
Sounds like it. From having been anosmic during the pandemic to then hearing about super tasters and having people close to me that are essentially super tasters, I know that it's more of a curse than it is a blessing sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. And that's really the superpower that we're looking for, is they're working on the genetic markers for people who have super smell abilities, which is just they have more of these odor binding proteins naturally. And so those proteins bind with a lot more odors. They're sensitive to a lot more odors. So maybe one day we'll have super smellers, and that will be the genetic marker that we want instead of super taster.
Maybe someday we'll have certified super smellers.
There you go.
So Mandy, where can people find your book, and where can people get to know more about you and your work?
Yeah, so the book is howtotastebook.com, but it's just about everywhere. Pretty much anywhere you can order a book, your small local bookshops, bigger chains, you'll find How to Taste, a guide to discovering flavor and savoring life. I'm Drinks with Mandy across social media. I've just recently gotten back on TikTok, so we'll see if that sticks. But yeah, posting about drinks, history, tasting, all those kind of things. And that's also where I post book events, and I do some kind of like online free things from time to time. So a place to go learn about flavor and the things that make drinking more interesting and fun.
So I suggest everybody goes out there, go follow her on Instagram, TikTok, and all the social media platforms. Get the book, really. I had the opportunity of reading the book during a couple of flights, and it was really well written, very entertaining. And as a food scientist, getting the information translated in a way that it's reading friendly and that it allows you to remember it, I think that it takes great skill to do that. So I really commend you for that.
Oh, thank you. I so wanted it to not read as a textbook, but secretly teach people things that might be in a textbook. So that's like the best feedback I can hear. I love it.
So we are in an evolving world of tasting and aromatic profiles and learning more about how these things work. We are actually seeing more and more books on this matter. So I suggest you start with that one. Get yourself into that topic, learn a little bit more, follow Mandy, and also follow the Food Engineer podcast. This interview is going to be in the podcast format in audio as well as in YouTube. So you will be able to see Mandy and, you know, talk about these things, see my reactions to when she talks about things like Russian River, see the book. Can you put the book there again?
Yeah, I always have a copy within arm's reach, you know.
So thank you so much, Mandy. Thanks for dedicating the time for this. And yeah, I hope to get you here soon again to talk more about your next project.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun, to chat, and good to be back.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Food Engineer Podcast es escrito, producido y editado por este servidor, Cristian Mercado, y es traído a ustedes gracias a Caldamentum, una compañía de consultoría para la industria de alimentos y bebidas. La música que escuchan se titula Until We Meet Again y es del álbum Piedra del señor Pedro Lavezzari. Vayan a Bandcamp y compren este un último álbum Piedra del señor Pedro Lavezzari para así demostrarle apoyo a esa persona que ha apoyado este podcast desde el principio. Quiero darle muchas gracias a Mandy Naglich y a todos ustedes por escuchar este podcast, aunque haya tenido un pequeño hiato de unos cuantos meses dado proyectos personales. Espero que sigan aquí conmigo y espero que sigan apoyando mi podcast y otros proyectos que vienen por ahí. Así que hasta pronto.